is Radio City. John Grayson, Rob Ross, yet another episode of the broadcast, up to 32 in this incarnation of the program. And Rob Ross, I just want to know, when the national anthem played, did you take a knee?
No, but I took a shit, if that'll help.
What an ungodly weekend. We'll be talking plenty about this, about this slap fight that, for whatever reason, Donald Trump has now decided to start with the National Football League. But we have plenty to jump into, and a bunch of sad goodbyes and fond farewells over the last couple of weeks. And we talked about a couple of them last week, but there were some major oversights on our part with leaving some names out of that list, starting with the guy who may very well have been my favorite manager ever when it comes to professional wrestling, of the guys that I grew up watching. Bobby the Brain Heenan was so much fun to hate, and that's what professional wrestling was back then, is finding those guys. You always had the guys that you were pulling for, but the guys that you loved to hate were even better. I mean, it was so much more fun to get that side of the coin, and Heenan played it brilliantly.
Heenan, to me, was the heir apparent to Fred Blassie's throne, because Fred Blassie, of course, was the king. Well, he was the king of men.
Yeah.
You know, the Hollywood fashion plate. But Heenan had the wit.
Right.
And the very dry, deadpan delivery. His greatest line of all of them was when he stood there and, you know, was doing an interview with Gene Okerlund, who was the perfect foil, and drew his hand out upon the crowd and said, "Just remember something, Okerlund. These people are allowed to vote and breed."
Right, and that's the thing, and everybody could boo him and hate him.
I loved Heenan. I wanted him to be my manager since Blassie had retired. You know, because I was and forever will be a heel.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. And he reveled in it. And that was the great thing about it, is that he played the game so well and reveled in the fact that all of the guys on his roster were the bad guys, but who cared?
Well, the thing is, you had a lot of those managers, quote unquote, who just didn't have the panache that somebody like Heenan, and right before Heenan, the true masters, like Blassie,
yep,
like Lou Albano, like the Grand Wizard. You know, those guys really knew how to do the heel manager to a T.
Right.
Heenan was obviously a student / disciple of theirs. So he knew how to work it, because everyone else in Heenan's wake was so poor. If it wasn't disgraceful and demeaning to the sacred art of wrestling, then it was laughable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like Oliver Humperdinck or Percy Pringle, a.k.a. Paul Bearer, these guys were just – these guys were – in Heenan's own words, these guys were ham and eggers.
Right.
So come on. There's no comparison. Bobby Heenan was truly a great – character. He was a great ambassador for wrestling, and even though he was a heel manager, he loved the fans and they loved him, because they would go to him like flies to honey.
Right. And he played up his own hype so well. It was just incredible. So a sad goodbye to him as well. And a guy that in the musical world didn't come to fame until much later than most people do. I mean, we get to know most people when they're in their 20s, and they usually do their best work in their late 20s or early 30s. But when it comes to a guy like Charles Bradley, most people didn't even know who he was until he was well past middle age. So to see him go at 68 means that he had, at least as a star in soul music, a fairly short career. But boy, did he do a lot in it.
Well, the thing is, he was 61 by the time he became, quote, a success.
Right.
By the time he was on the map, because it was only a 7-year run that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And like Sharon Jones, who also came to it very late, you know, they were both part of the incredible Daptone label / universe.
Right.
And now they're left without anyone of that kind of, no pun intended, soulful power and merit. I mean, this was a guy who could take rock songs and give them a soul life that you would never imagine. He had a voice that was so pure and so down home. You would have thought that he was one of the masters of High Records or Stax way back when, and was having a career revival. Not knowing that he just toiled on the smaller circuits and had a career, you know, working away from music. But yeah, we lost him, of course, to cancer naturally. So, you know, it's another major loss for music, for quality music.
Right. And as you said, I mean, there's always been a quality about great soul music that it has to sound world-weary. It has to sound wise. And when you've got somebody who really has earned those stripes, even though he didn't, as you said, become famous until he was 61 years old, it just makes sense at that point, and it just sounds so rich and gorgeous, you know?
And he, you know, the productions, because Daptone has a certain style and quality, as I used the word before, of its own, you know, they knew how to make him sound his absolute best. And when you heard that voice, it was just rich.
Right, right. And, you know, one guy from the acting realm as well, because I don't know. I mean, you know, again, was there ever anybody who was able to play that guy who always had a slight level of sleaze to him, although you always liked him better than Harry Dean Stanton?
He was probably America's finest character actor, bar none.
Yeah.
To me, he was just a fucking Repo Man.
That's right. And Repo Man's always intense.
The other thing is, you'll also always feel that moment of pity for him being Andy's father, mainly because she was whiny and she should have gone off with Ducky and not with Blaine. I mean, Blaine, that's a household appliance, but, you know.
Right. And for me, he'll always be Lieutenant Junkins in Christine. Another part that, I mean, it was a bit part, but most of his were. And yet he played it so completely brilliantly. And, he, you know, here he is acting with a bunch of nobodies and it didn't make any difference. I mean, he just shined and he brought everything together in that movie.
Well, you just said something that's very key, and that is, you know, a bit part. He was the master of the bit part, but when he came on screen, he stole the performances. He stole the movies.
Yep.
He was the shining moment of all of them.
Right. And there was a quality about the way that he delivered lines that it was, you know what it is? I'm a big fan of Stan Ridgway from Wall of Voodoo. And to me, if you took Stan Ridgway and stretched him up about a foot and made him an actor instead of a singer, he'd be Harry Dean Stanton.
I don't know how Stan would feel about that. You should ask him that.
That's
tell
right.
Him, tell him like on the air comparison. Who knows? He might write a song about it.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, they both had that same kind of, you know, curl at the corner of the mouth, kind of almost growl of a delivery sometimes. And I love that because it came off. You know what? Harry Dean Stanton could make any movie a noir, is what it is. And it just worked.
He basically walked out of the 40s.
Right, right.
You know, and into, quote, stardom in the 80s. And I think that's quite a feat,
yeah,
to say the least. But let's say our last farewell to someone who maybe many people wouldn't know him by name, but they knew him for two roles, and those two roles will always be his legacy. They knew him as either Phil Leotardo, you know, a gangster name for a piece of footwear,
right?
Who, of course, said the immortal line, "Wave the pop, pop," and then got popped in the back of the head, and his head was run over by an SUV. Or, most importantly, Billy Batts.
Exactly.
To which I say, "Now go home and get your fucking shine box."
You motherfucker!
Keeping me in that fucking mud.
Yeah, you know, and what was great is that in both of the roles that he was famous for, he got the shit beat out of him by Joe Pesci.
This is true. Except he did. That's right. The baseball bat in Casino.
Right.
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 Okay. That's very, very fair indeed. Although Pesci beat the shit out of him in the end in Goodfellas.
Right. Right. So, yeah.
They shot him in the face so they couldn't give him an open casket. Right.
But, yeah, you know, another guy who just, he showed up in a couple of places, but those couple of places will go down in movie history is just absolute brilliance.
What's the one scene everybody loves in Goodfellas more than any other? It's Get Your Fucking Shine Box.
Right.
The one of two lines that people always remember from Goodfellas, go home and get your fucking shine box, or fuck you, pay me.
Right. And you know, as a part of a scene like that, you know, we could almost go off on an In Our Heads segment about something like that, about those guys who only ever showed up once, but boy, was it a memorable thing. We'll have to keep that one in our pockets.
All right, let's do that, because we're getting older and we tend to forget things very easily.
That's right. Oh, yeah, and so a sad farewell to all of those guys, because very, very talented gentlemen. So each and every one of them gave us something to remember. And we've got a lot to go over on today's show. We kind of edged into it a minute ago with the fact that now the President of the United States, who, by the way, single-handedly fucked up the USFL, it's his fault. His fault alone that football league died in 1986. Now he's decided to start a slap fight with the National Football League. And instead of having a couple of guys go relatively unnoticed for kneeling down on the sidelines during the national anthem, now the entire Pittsburgh Steelers football team didn't even come out of the field during the national anthem before today's game. And there's a far bigger spotlight on it now. And there have been dozens and dozens and dozens of players who have decided to join in Kaepernick's protest, and Kaepernick's not even playing this year.
One. Who are the Seahawks playing?
I don't know.
Because whoever it is, both teams just decided to not come out until after the national anthem.
Right.
Second of all of these sons of bitches, all of them, Donald Trump, these fucking football players, this is the kind of thing that shows you how wrong every one of these people are.
Yep.
The left and the right. Because all of this nonsense was started by one asshole, one disrespectful asshole who thought he was making a grand statement. A guy whose career was already way down at the end of its tether. Because, as you know, Kaepernick can't play.
Right.
So now this asshole is getting all this attention shed on him because he wants to play again and nobody wants to sign him. Well, you and I have talked this to death. He can't play, and I wouldn't sign a guy who can't play.
Right.
I'd just as soon sign Jay Cutler. He can't play either, but he can play better. He managed to at least get one touchdown today against the Jets, who actually won their first game of the season.
Right.
But this whole issue really is, in the grand scheme of things, a non-issue. Here's my take on it, and I'll keep it simple. I think it is incredibly disrespectful to anyone and everyone, whether they're the fans, especially, management, or your teammates, to not at the very least stand quietly while the national anthem is played. Making one of these statements by taking the knee is disrespectful to all, because it's disrespectful to the general populace. Okay? Disrespect is disrespect. Pure and simple. It's your right to, quote unquote, have a form of protest. But in the big picture, and that's what people always tend to forget because they're so myopic in their own hangups and their own cause celebs, that they don't look at the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
Taking the knee is an absolutely meaningless gesture because you know what? It foments intense scrutiny and extreme dislike of you. Stand there, keep your mouth shut if somebody asks you. Then you can speak about it. Speak about whatever your feelings on the various topics you may be wanting to protest are. You have every right. It's called freedom of speech. But the thing is, an outward sign of disrespect is just that. It's a thumb-nosing towards everyone. And your constituency, your fan base, will certainly turn on you then. There's no question about it. But Donald Trump ratcheting it up and doing what, as you always say, well, don't worry, there's always next week. He'll fuck it all up somehow. This is proof positive of it.
Right.
You know, wish we could laugh about it, but there's no truer words spoken, because you can set your clock by him because of his consistency to be both an asshole, a provocateur, and a fuck up. All of the above.
Right.
Never mind that he's the President of the United States. He's still an asshole of the highest caliber.
Right, and needlessly so. I mean, it gains him nothing. Now, on the other hand, it loses him nothing either, because now that all these guys in the NFL are taking part in these protests who may not have otherwise, and now that he's taken a whole bunch of heat for this, for doing what he always does, by the way, which is lying out his ass, you know, all this shit with tweeting, oh, poor ratings. The ratings won't be released until later tonight, by the way, for the NFL games, so he's just pulling shit straight out of his ass and tweeting it as though it's fact, because that's what he does. And he's been hung up by that before, by the way. So in the grand scheme of things, though, it won't hurt him. It won't really make any difference because his base doesn't care. and it's not against the law. But if you watch what's really going on, where right now he's doing this for fun. Okay, the slap fight with the NFL, he's doing it for fun. It's the kind of stuff he likes doing. You're a New Yorker. I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but just for general information, this is what he does. But if you watch what his reactions are and how different they are when it comes to the Russia investigation, he is vindictive and defensive and crazy whenever Russia comes up. Which means he knows that's what can really hurt him. I mean, nothing in this bullshit fight with the National Football League is going to end up with him in cuffs. That might, and he knows it. So, you know, it's not going to happen this week. It's not going to happen next week. But in the meantime, you know, what's he doing? He's trying to distract attention by doing shit like this and by starting a fight with North Korea, which...
And don't forget also the NBA, too.
Right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's a dangerous game. And, you know, the North Korean thing, that won't hurt him, but it might very well hurt a bunch of our kids. Great.
It's also going to hurt North Korea.
Yeah.
In ways that, you know, sanctions aside, the fact is, unfortunately, if they are stupid and callous enough to fire any more missiles, I mean, they're walking perilously close now, having fired missiles over Japan.
Right.
Who I think are just about ready to not take any more of their shenanigans. There are going to be a lot of North Koreans that are going to die.
Yeah, right.
That's, you know, a sad fact. But the thing is, it's typical of Trump to obfuscate what's really happening. That is the, quote, news that matters, because he knows it can hurt him, as you very wisely pointed out. The thing is, if the NFL collectively had a half a brain in its obvious mush heads, which it doesn't, you know, they wouldn't have taken the bait. They wouldn't have said anything. They might have just quietly said something about, you know, the president is entitled to his opinion, and left it at that.
Yeah.
Everybody always has to take the bait, especially now whenever Donald Trump opens his mouth. I mean, we've been through this bit a million times already also. People need to learn, and they're going to have to learn the hard way, obviously, that the only way to beat Trump is just not to bother in reacting to him. Let him say what he wants. He'll find something else to rant about, because he knows once he can't penetrate you and can't penetrate your steel, if you will, then he'll have to find somebody else who he thinks he can get to or get at.
Right.
But the NFL took the bait. And you've got these guys who are probably amongst the dumbest human beings on the planet to begin with. You know, I'm sorry. I think out of all the major sports, football players, most of those guys don't have their college degrees are all useless. You know, I have no great respect or love for football players. They all come off as being just a bunch of overbearing, incredibly wealthy, arrogant, I can do whatever the fuck I want kind of people. Now, I may be
kind of like the president. Jealous.
Right. And the one why it's the perfect foil for him. But I mean, these guys are a bunch of douchebags. These are guys who are known already for smacking their women around in elevators, getting caught on camera, and nobody blinks an eye. How many guys committed, you know, attempted murders and stabbings and stuff, got off on all charges and managed to have football careers.
Right.
I think the only one, like we've talked about again, Ray Carruth is the only one who wound up in jail for actually killing somebody and not getting away with it.
Right.
You know, I mean, Aaron Hernandez, yeah, that fucking guy deserved to be in jail, and there's no tears for him. So when it comes to the NFL, it gets what it deserves too, because they've gotten away with, no pun intended, murder for a long time.
Well, here's why I'm glad you brought up Aaron Hernandez, because he was also in the news this week because they cut his head open and found out that he had massive CTE. And the problem, I think, with that news story is he was a piece of shit before he entered the NFL. You know, he was, granted, all of the things that go wrong with the concussions and the brain injuries and all of that, somebody's got to get a grip on that, and they've got to do it soon. But don't give me this, oh, Aaron Hernandez was a product of CTE. No, he was always a violent asshole. Always.
Yes. He was scum.
Yep.
You know, he got lucky having a career in football. And did he do anything with his life with it?
No, he fucked it up.
Fucked it up and then some while taking another life. So, you know what? They're going to try and spin it as much as they want because of the money that's involved here.
Yep.
But be sure that people will come to the conclusion that no. he already was like this before football.
Into the world of entertainment, we head out of the NFL, out of the sort of real life entertainment that's going on. But there's a couple of things that happened over the last week, and wanted to go over some of them with you because I don't normally watch award shows. I tend to stay away from them entirely. But every so often, I'll watch some of one. And I like Stephen Colbert, so I watched some of the Emmys. How much of the show did you catch?
I saw the very, very end because I was waiting for the news to come on.
Okay.
And
you didn't miss much.
I heard, no kidding, I heard the precious speech made by the, I guess, the head writer or creator of The Handmaid's Tale.
Yep.
Which is more bullshit than I could handle in general because everybody trying to equate their current works as being, you know, an allegory for – no, it's not. It was a shitty book that Margaret Atwood wrote years ago. It was a shitty movie made years ago. And now it's a shitty TV series starring a Scientologist.
Yeah.
So save it, sweetheart. You're not conning me. But I heard later on about what actually happened on this. And, you know, it is kind of a head-scratching thing. Everybody's hand-wringing, you and cry about Sean Spicer appearing with the motorized
podium.
Thank you. The motorized podium and trying to be cutesy funny amidst gasps of disbelief and shock and awe in the audience.
Which was, by the way, the point.
You know what, people? We've seen much, much worse than this before on awards shows, okay? We saw streakers coming up behind David Niven.
Right.
Sasheen Littlefeather.
Yep.
You know? And, of course, we had George C. Scott didn't bother to show up because he went to a hockey game. To me, now, that's a bigger statement right there.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, the Spicer thing, look, it was supposed to be exactly what it was. It was supposed to be a shocking thing that was going to get that kind of gasp laugh out of everybody. And it did. And for people to come out afterwards and say, oh, no, how could
they
do that?
It's normalization. It's normalization. That's the word. That's the buzzword of the moment. You're normalizing it. You're giving it credibility.
It was a self-congratulatory bullshit awards show. So
thank you, because that was my next line.
Well, what exactly did he ruin? You know what I mean? I mean, how do you ruin something that's already crap?
Do I really have to sit here? And by the way, it's an award show for TV.
Yeah. Right.
Stupid medium. It's not for movies. It's for the idiot box.
Right.
Which we all tune into because that's how we're wired.
And the streaming thing, the only thing interesting to me about the Emmys this year is the fact that The Handmaid's Tale notwithstanding, it won. I haven't watched a single episode of it, and I won't because of that Scientologist crackpot, but it's on a streaming service. And where when the Cable Ace Awards went away years ago, the idea of taking cable TV and lumping it in with the rest of the Emmys, all of a sudden, all the cable shows started winning because they don't have the same restrictions the networks do. So now we're seeing the streaming services go a step farther, but there's one thing that everybody's missing, and that is that Hulu's production house and Netflix's production house and Amazon's production house are bleeding money like crazy. Now, they're making up for it, or they're making up for a lot of it with the money that comes in via the subscriptions and all of this stuff. But yeah, they're getting a whole bunch of big stars because they're paying out the ass for them. And they're getting great writers because they're paying out the ass for them. It's an unsustainable business model. So enjoy it while you've got it. And enjoy, you know, shows like The Handmaid's Tale or Atypical or all of those. They're really, really well done. But if you think that 5 years from now, Hulu, Netflix, Amazon, blah, 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 are going to be able to sustain that model, you're nuts.
Most of those shows are going to go down in flames in a short amount of time anyway, because guess what? Like every other TV series in history, ideas run out, interest runs out.
Yep.
You know, short attention spans.
Right.
It's that simple. People aren't going to be riveted in 2 years' time to The Handmaid's Tale. They're going to find something else to occupy themselves.
Sure. Well, and they're also going through the same thing that the networks went through when USA and TNT and all of them started producing original programming, which is that it's watering the field down even farther. You couldn't possibly catch up with every one of those shows. You can't keep up with them. There's just too much. If you have a job, you know, and you have to sleep, there's not enough hours in the day.
if you have a life, you're not sitting there going, oh, I have to catch every episode.
Right.
The whole notion of, you know, binge-watching television, it's just another form of drug to me.
Yep.
Because the key word is binge. Binge is a dangerous word, and people really need to learn how to temper that. Well, I realize I'm preaching to the to the perverted out there.
Yes.
But, you know, here's, you know, something, since we're on the topic of social anomalies and things that are going on in the world around us, what's happening in St. Louis? Because suddenly I've heard absolutely nothing since last week.
Yeah.
Like it went away overnight.
It has been a very strange week around here because the protests have been ongoing. There have been protests every day in different parts of town. And they shut down or tried to shut down another mall. And this one was in an area town called Brentwood, which, as the name would suggest, is a kind of a ritzy, frou-frou, nouveau riche sort of area. And they tried that and they got thrown out of the mall. And I think they actually shut the mall down for a short period of time. And then they went to a Target store nearby and tried to shut that down. And the cops lined up in the door, you know, and wouldn't let them in. And the only reason I know that is because my son happens to work three stores away from that Target store and he saw the whole thing go down. But it's so disjointed. And that's the thing, is that the protests haven't been violent since last weekend. At least not anything major. I'm sure there have been a couple of rocks thrown and maybe a couple of guys busted, but it hasn't been Ferguson all over again. But where these things are happening though, there's no cohesiveness. There's no plan. Right. And nobody seems to know. That's a great question, because it's like, if you ask 10 of the protesters at any given protest, what is it that you want to do here? You're going to get 10 different answers. And the one thing that seems to be a consistent thread is, we want to disrupt commerce so people will listen to us. Okay, first of all, disrupting commerce is only going to hurt the business owners, and they're going to hate you, and they're still not going to listen to you. And second of all, okay, you want them to listen to you. Say what that you haven't said yet.
And what are the responses to that?
Yeah, not much. Just kind of jaws dropping and people going, well, we want to be heard. Okay.
Right, you just said that. Now elaborate.
Yeah, right. And there is no message. There is no
actual agenda.
Right. And you see people carrying the same signs they always carry. No justice, no peace. Okay. What is it that you want to have happen so that we can get closer to a just society?
Am I crazy, or was it in St. Louis or in the St. Louis area where the cops started chanting back at the protesters?
Yeah, our streets, right. Yeah, whose streets, our streets. And that's not cool either.
Because what you're doing there, I get it, because you're pissed and you're tired.
Right.
And you're tired of being pissed and pissed on and you know, dragged through the mud needlessly for this kind of thing. But don't do that. You're fanning the flames, because that's the kind of one little thing will set these assholes off. Now, question, is BLM out there? Are they part of this?
At times, yes. And here's the other funny thing that actually predates all of this, is that over the spring and early part of the summer here in St. Louis, these Black Lives Matter protests started happening on the streets kind of, I was going to say organically, but that's not the right word, because they were set up through social media. But the couple of times that I saw them, and I swear to you, this is true, it was a dozen people, you know, maybe a little bit more than that. And again, this is before the big protest started over the acquittal. But they were all white, every single one of them. It's weird to see a Black Lives Matter protest without anybody black in it.
Well, let me ask you something, though. Going back to a question I've asked before, if Black Lives Matter, where were they in Houston? Where were they in Florida after the hurricanes? They're supposed to be a group about, I thought, about, you know, caring for their own. Or is it just another rabble-rousing gang of thugs and miscreants who just want to fuck with people?
Right, and just want to fight. They want to spoil for a fight. And then what is the fight about? We'll figure it out after the fight's over.
Right, they're just into fighting because they think it's going to make them look like martyrs in the end.
Right.
But here's what we've said time and time again. Black lives don't matter to them unless it's something that's, you know, a lot more nebulous, frankly. When it's something serious like a hurricane, they're not saying or doing anything.
Right.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, Houston has an incredibly large black population.
Yep.
Florida has a pretty large population all around. I don't recall Black Lives Matter chipping in to help anywhere, you know, manpower or any of that kind of thing.
Right.
Trying to, you know, clear rubble. So your organization is absolutely meaningless.
Now, on the other side of that, as you said, the whose streets are thing, our streets thing wasn't helping as far as the cops are concerned. The other thing, and this is something to watch to see if this gets out of this area, is that during the protests, the police were doing something called kettling. You ever heard of this?
No, I haven't.
Neither had I. What they do is, let's say there's a protest going on, and you're going to find 100 people, 150 people involved in the protest. On the periphery of that, you're going to find people who are just walking by. You're going to find people who are spectators who just want to see what happens during the protest and all of this. So when the police decide to make a line and declare the protest unlawful, they've been doing this thing called kettling, where they'll set up a small cadre of police at all of the egresses where you could possibly get out of the area. And then they'll kind of funnel everybody into one block and then arrest everybody. The problem is they don't seem to care whether they arrest people who are taking part in the protest or people who just kind of got caught up in the mush. They've already arrested a couple of journalists. They've already arrested people who had no interest in the protest whatsoever. And one lady said she asked the police, she said, "I'm not involved in this. How do I get out of here?" And they pointed her right into the kettle and then busted her. So if this shit keeps up, you know, again, you're going to have even more problems and even more things for people to protest.
Because then the police are going to lose the people who have been, if
not
on
their side, yep.
Right, supportive. Well, this is where it seems to get ugly. But the reason I asked was because it was starting last week when we had our last conversation, but almost as quickly as it had been, you know, frontline news, I would say I've heard nothing since maybe Monday night.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, they've... Well, when they figured out that there wasn't going to be any more tear gas, because tear gas looks great on TV. So when they figured out there wasn't going to be any more tear gas and there weren't going to be any more people shot with rubber bullets, the national press left.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Then again, the national press is busy with, you know, fake news. So
that's right. They got to make up another Russia story. So
although, hang on. There's blame on both sides. You know we're going to use that at every, probably in every show. It's going
right.
to be like flying somewhere, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of bad hombres involved in the news.
Of course. Yeah, well, I'm one of them. And on that subject, by the way, what's happening in New York? Anything new with the mayor?
No, but we just had, obviously, the primaries, which were very distressing for me locally because the person who is our North Shore representative and who's been a do-nothing as long as she's been in the office, unfortunately, won the Democratic nomination again. However, hopefully the Republican, and yes, I'm saying hopefully the Republican, will beat her.
Yeah.
The Republican is the guy who doesn't want overbuilding on marshlands and wetlands to prevent more flooding, should God forbid we have another Sandy kind of situation, whereas...
Yeah.
The woman who is our current rep, the do-nothing Democrat, Debbie Rose, all she does is you know, look for places for them to build. And what are they building? Things that have absolutely nothing for Staten Islanders. It is to draw in, she thinks, in her deluded way, it's going to bring in people from the other boroughs. No one wants to come to Staten Island. That's a very sad fact. I've had friends for 20, 25 years who've never come over here out of the lack of knowledge, out of the non-understanding of how easy it is to get to and fro by ferry. There's a million and one excuses, but the fact is that it's not going to draw revenue. And all she does is want to keep building. And it's things that are not essential for the area itself. case in point, where we are, which is a very family-oriented neighborhood, it's a mixture. You know, you've got median income, you've got lower income, but it's a neighborhood. You see people around this neighborhood on the street, and you will always have somebody saying to you, hi, how are you? You know each other. You know your neighbors.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of families here. We are in dire need of a proper grocery store, okay? A full-service grocery store, a chain, something. We don't have one of those here. And she's not pushing to get something like that built. No, she's busy trying to get nonsense built over here, you know?
No, see, Rob, you're missing the point. What you really, you don't know this because you only live there, but what you really need is another Applebee's.
Right, or in our case of having, well, it's great that it's going to have sustainable jobs and having the outlet mall here. We really don't need the Gucci outlet store in this neighborhood. And yeah, an Applebee's will be part of that.
Of course it will. But you know, what do you know? You're only a resident.
Right. You know, only a resident of 27 years in this neighborhood, never mind being a Staten Islander for 50 of my 52 years.
Yeah.
But that's what this woman is about. And when I tell you, if you were to look her up on the net and watch her speak, you can see the wheels grinding slowly, albeit excessively dumb, because everything she says is just this rehearsed and memorized nothing. You know, a whole, you know, talking loud and saying nothing. She's a master of that. And any time that there's a photo op that she could stick her grinning mug into, she'll do it. Case in point, when they reopened the ferry the first Friday after Sandy, when I was down there for that first ferry back across into Manhattan, she made sure she was there for the photo op, but she couldn't answer a goddamn question that any of the constituents waiting there at the ferry asked her, nor could she answer the local reporters from New York One, which is the New York City cable news network.
Of course, yeah.
She's as useless as the Pope's balls, okay? And that's the fact. So as far as the New York elections go, and de Blasio, he's just showing what a fucking communist he is. There is an article that was written about him shooting off his opinion of how if he had his way, you know, he would be able to dictate how rents should go and how, you know, who should be able to live where by virtue of affordability. You commie son of a bitch.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well,
son of a bitch.
Yeah. And in the meantime, the gubernatorial, see, I always talk about St. Louis, but I actually live on the Illinois side of the river. And, there's a race going on right now for governor because Bruce Rauner has been such an amazing asshole ever since he took over. And, you know, Rauner took over in a special election that was held when Rod Blagojevich went to prison. And there's only three ways that governors in Illinois ever leave office. And the more common way is in handcuffs. Some of them die.
And, I was going to say, dying.
Yeah, and then occasionally, one actually gets voted out. And that may happen with Rauner. But the guy who's running against him, and I don't know very much about the guy's history. The election's still a ways off. But he looks almost exactly like an overinflated Rod Blagojevich, which I think may actually hurt him in the long run. It's like, don't you look a little like that guy who just went to prison for trying to sell a Senate seat?
And whose party, which is which party?
Rauner's he's the incumbent and he's a Republican. And that's the first time Illinois has had a Republican governor in a very long time.
Boy, oh boy. Christ.
It never ends. But on that happy note, we get to talk a little music, and we've got some more to go over as well. Before we do the music thing, you had mentioned something on TV a while ago outside of the Emmys that we've seen yet another series come to an end. What was it?
Oh, The Strain. The final episode of The Strain ran last week. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, for those who know of the show, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. For those of you who don't know the show, it's about how a very ugly plague overtakes starting in New York City and turns people into vampires. And not just your average, you know, I want to bite your neck kind of, you know, sexy vampires. These creatures are pretty hideous.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's Nazis in it, you know, and the Nazi chasing his old tormented, you know, Jew prisoner from the days of being in Auschwitz together. And it's a great bunch of sub-stories and a nuclear bomb that goes off and wipes out most of New York, you know, trying to kill off these vampires. And how the vampires won round one after the nuclear blast.
Okay.
Long story short, the series came to an end. I thought it was a very satisfying ending because the good guys win.
Good.
No spoiler alert there. The last word, you know, the kind of epilogue that was told was a little on the trite and treacly side, but you know what? The good guys won.
Yeah.
So you can only take these kinds of series for a short term, and this was, I believe, the fourth year. You couldn't really run it too much further until you ran it right into the ground. But I thought the strain went out on a high note. There are a lot of series out there right now that could definitely take a couple of lessons from that.
Good.
So,
well,
it's a good one.
I do have one other thing to add about TV this week is that we did, I know we mentioned this on the last episode, and we did not get a chance to watch the final episode of The Sinner. So we'll have to hold that off until next week, and then we'll do the wrap-up on that. It was a 10-episode sort of mini-series-ish thing that was, I don't even remember which network it was on, but it was fairly good, at least so far. Is it USA?
It's USA. Now, was that just planned? Is that one run and that's it, one and done?
I think so. But again, these things always go by how much interest it garnered. And I'll tell you, for a show that was as high quality as it was, and again, I mean, it had Jessica Biel and Bill Pullman and Catherine Irby and a whole bunch of others, and I haven't heard it buzzed about very much at all. So I would guess that, yeah, this is going to be it. They're done.
Interesting that with the one and done concept, because I don't remember the name of the show itself, but Ashley Judd had done a series, if you remember,
right,
on ABC, where she played a spy, and you know, it had people like Sean Bean, who very foolishly left the first season of Game of Thrones thinking that this show was going to be a master hit. Oh boy.
Yeah.
You know, Keith Carradine was in it, and so on. Really well done, really intriguing, made you tune in week after week. It's Ashley Judd, to me, the most perfect woman that has ever walked the face of the earth.
Yep.
It was getting great ratings, but yet somehow ABC decided to pull the plug just before they aired the final episode, so they shot a quick final ending to it as a wrap-up.
Uh-huh.
Because they got the word that it wasn't going to be coming back. Unlike, for argument's sake, those pricks at Cinemax leaving Quarry hanging.
Right, right. And we've seen that happen, unfortunately, going all the way back to, well, the beginning of television, where they would kill things off while they were in hiatus. But
and hey, by the way, I got to throw this in. Last night, the movie, our Saturday night movie was Wonder Woman.
Oh, nice. Okay. And?
I enjoyed it much more than I ever expected that I would. I could watch Gal Gadot day and night now.
Yep.
Oh my. Oh my. That girl has got it all. She's adorable. She's gorgeous. She's hot as fuck. She's really got charisma.
Right. And she's got the chops. Right.
She's got the chops. She also is actually very funny. And I did a little bit of research and I had no idea. She actually started out in a sitcom in Israel. So she's actually got the funny, too.
Right.
Which you would usually equate with Israeli chicks. Because they just snap your neck, call it foreplay.
Yep.
You know, and it just makes me think that's what this country needs. Some more Israeli female soldiers on TV and in films.
Sounds good to me. Which
there is nothing hotter on the planet. I believe me, I can vouch for that. I once dated a woman who was a fighter pilot.
And by the way, Happy New Year.
And to you, too.
And I, you know what this means, though, is that if for the next month I'm going to be writing 5776 on my checks. So there's that.
Right now I'm having a regular Coke in preparation for this kind of this Friday night's attempt yet again at Yom Kippur. You know, I'm going to fail miserably somewhere around, oh, say, 9 o'clock Saturday morning.
Right.
Because I'll wake up really hungry and in dire need of coffee. But if I can go at least 8 or 9 hours without eating. At 52, you know what? I got nothing else to worry about sin-wise.
There you go.
I don't sin much. I may be pissed off, but I got nothing to atone for, right? Because everybody's done me wrong. I'm a Jew. I'm a victim, remember?
Exactly, right. But on the streaming service thing.
But you, on the other hand, we had this discussion online. Now, did you ever find a temple, or are you going full bore and going to start going to shul, which means then you have to grow a beard and
No, we did find a temple, and it's on the St. Louis side of the river. It's in West St. Louis County, which, if you know the geography, shouldn't surprise anybody. And
they
it's
got Jesus in St. Louis?
Huh? Yeah, believe it or not, yeah, there's more than a few. And it's a very progressive place, and the rabbi, she's wonderful, very, very nice lady. So yeah, we'll be hanging out there for a little while. But thank you. And on the streaming television thing, I just wanted to add one thing that because we're looking at cutting the cord. We're looking at finally getting rid of DirecTV. I'll go watch my Bills games somewhere else because they have pissed me off for the last time, and their equipment is shit. So this is the third DVR that will have given up the ghost with about 25 or 30 hours worth of programming still on it. And there's nothing they can do. They can't swap out the hard drives, so you just lose everything when their box takes a shit, which happens a lot.
Would you go back to regular cable?
No, and that's the thing. I hate the cable company around here. It's Charter, and screw them. They're not getting any of my money. There's a couple of different ways to do it. Hulu has a service that's all streaming, but you can get your local channels on it. And there's one other one. The local phone company, believe it or not, is also a content provider, and they have a kind of a Fios package that's fairly cheap. And so we're kind of looking at that. We may go all streaming. We're not really sure. But the interesting thing is that with the Fire Stick or the any of the set-top boxes, they have a zillion apps now that are free TV, and some of it's live and some of it's just stuff you can watch, old TV shows and old movies. But the game changer was when I downloaded a couple of the free ones just to scope out what they had, and I found out that a couple of them have porn. Now, it's cable porn, you know, it's not like hardcore, you know, Pornhub porn, but still, the fact that there's free...
If it's not Pornhub porn, it's not worth your time. It's the titillation effect. It's Cinemax.
Right, exactly. That's what it is. So the fact that that's out there for free... You know, and I think that's once word starts to get out about that, that's what's really going to make a difference. And for people who have been scared off of going with all streaming, they're going to go, really? Porn's out there too? Eh, what the hell? And as you know, if you can still through one of the boxes, if you can still get the local channels plus all of the other stuff, then what's the point? You know, and a lot of them now also carry USA and TNT and TBS and all of those. You know, as part of their subscription service. So it's all, you know, you don't really lose anything. We're still, I'll tell you, I'll let you know where we end up with all of this because we're not there yet, but we're getting there.
In the boroughs, you're basically enslaved to one cable company. Charter, as a matter of fact,
yeah.
Spectrum, because they took over Time Warner.
Right.
Although certain edges of Queens and Brooklyn go with Cablevision.
Okay.
Cox Cablevision, which is out in Long Island, but it's one cable company and that's it. You know, those two parts of Brooklyn and Queens and then all of Long Island, that's Cox. There's no Charter out there. You have regular cable. You have DirecTV. Does Dish TV exist anymore, by the way?
Yeah, Dish Network is still out there, but DirecTV is the one that has the NFL package, so nobody goes with Dish.
And Fios, Verizon Fios. Those are your three options in New York. And everyone I know who has had satellite has had no end of misery. That's one.
Yep.
Most of my friends who went Fios got rid of it as quickly as they'd gotten it before they realized, oh, shit, what have I done?
Okay.
So everybody's either abandoned any and all pay service for TV and just don't watch anything and they'll watch whatever they can on YouTube or sign on for the streaming services, or they just decided to go back to and stick with regular cable.
Yeah.
Right. Because here, oddly enough, cable, I'm going out on a limb, but it's not awful. You know, the worst I can say is occasionally they lose the signal. Occasionally. But I think the loss of the signal was far more prevalent when they made the changeover from Time Warner-based equipment to the Spectrum platform.
Right.
But otherwise, since that occurred, and that was already a year ago, Nothing.
Yeah, like I said, I think we're edging toward going as much streaming as we possibly can, and maybe all streaming, but if we do, I'll let you know. And there's one free app out there called Pluto TV, and Tubi is another one, and it's all free stuff, but Pluto actually has live streaming programming, and CNBC is on there, and there's a couple of Sky News, which is kind of cool. The other thing about it is that they also have a couple of comedy channels on that thing that are live streaming. And one of them is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week Mystery Science Theater 3000 channel. And for that alone, I downloaded the thing.
There you go. For you, it makes all the sense in the world.
So to music we go, and a couple of things to talk about. Now, we had, over the last couple of weeks, been spotlighting a bunch of records and some of the bigger releases, or at least the more impactful releases of 1984, which was the year that really music changed entirely. And it was a landmark year because so many great albums came out. We're going to take another look at yet another one this week on the broadcast. So where are we going this time?
Well, we're going to stay, I would think, in the vein that we were moving into last week when we talked about Who's Good News and Arcade, because the book and landmark album that went along with it, and as you know, Zen Arcade was a double LP, was the Minutemen's Double Nickels on the Dime, which was also two albums, 75 songs on two albums.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to also look at it in the proper perspective. It's the Minutemen. Their songs were almost always under a minute, if not less. The thing is, next to Zen Arcade, Double Nickels on the Dime was the second most, or tied for first place, most important album of 1984. Those two albums were the true game changers for the American underground, because with those two albums, you were given a completely new palette with all sorts of colors and variations that you probably hadn't considered or seen before. And the musicality shown by the Minutemen, even though most of their songs you would take, if you were a casual observer and listener, and think of as just snippets or incomplete packages, were in fact complete, the musicality went from punk rock, hardcore punk rock, freeform jazz, classic heavy rock, you name it, they did it. Three dudes, four sides, you know, no funny stuff.
Right.
You know, the legend goes, first of all, Double Nickels on the Dime is trucker slang for doing 55 dead on. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, when the Minutemen, because they were label mates with Husker Du on SST, heard that the Huskers were doing a double album, it made them, just for a joke, go back into the studio and write a batch more songs so that they could have it as a double album.
Uh-huh.
Open up the album, because we are talking about the album version. It does say, as the joke, on the side, take that, Huskers.
That's funny.
Sheer brilliance.
Right, right. Okay?
There was nothing but love between those two bands. Both of them were trios, you know. You know, the CD version of Double Nickels has never been restored to the actual album version because it's missing two songs. It's missing the band's reworking of their own Little Man with a Gun in His Hand. And it's also missing their 30-second notoriously brilliant version of Van Halen's Ain't Talking About Love.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this album also has incredible covers, you know, like them doing Creedence's Don't Look Down, It Ain't You or Me. It also has their version of Dr. Wu.
Katie lies. You can see it in her eyes. Imagine my surprise when I saw you. Are you with me, Dr. Wu? Are you really just a shadow of the man that I once knew? Just an ordinary guy. Have you done all you can do? Are you with your doctor?
But this is also the Minutemen album that most people know of. The Minutemen know that this is the album that has, dare I say the word, because of course no such thing exists, the hits. This is the album that has This Ain't No Picnic. This is the album that has Corona, which I'm fairly sure, unfortunately, most people Even though they all watched it or went to see the movie versions in droves, Corona was the theme song from Jackass.
Right, right.
Okay. This is the album that has History Lesson Part 2. This is the album that gave birth to the famous Minutemen slogan, "We Jam Econo," from the song "The Politics of Time," with the most amazing lyrical couplets. "We're time Nazis, we strip our tunes, we jam Econo, makes us stench." Fucking genius. Unadulterated genius.
Yeah.
There are four sides of interesting, different, diverse music, and the beauty of the fact that this band did these songs in these short, sharp, herky-jerky bursts is what makes it all the more interesting.
Couple of things that really stood out to me about this one. First of all, you mentioned the lyricism and the witticism. The fact that there's a song on this record called "Do You Want New Wave or Do You Want the Truth" that's just outstanding. Now, on top of that, the jazz influence on this is undeniable. You mentioned the freeform jazz piece of it, and that is what I think. We talked a couple of weeks ago, because of the loss of Walt Becker, about the fact that here you have, at the beginning of the 1970s, you have Steely Dan taking all of these incredible jazz influences and beautiful weird chords and things like that and infusing it into a very approachable soft rock kind of package, even though it was so much more than that. And that's what the Minutemen did with this record, is that they took those same kinds of influences and jammed them into hardcore punk. And it sounds so great. And the thing that I love about it is that they could have made these songs in a minute, minute and a half, 40 seconds, whatever it is, and made them slick. And made them shiny, and they would have been just as brilliant and just as interesting. But the fact that there's so much string buzz, and there's so much things that you can hear because they didn't wet it up, and because the vocals are just exactly that. It's just it's an open microphone, and that's it. And you got
one
to hear.
No funk business.
Right. Yeah. And you get to hear things like fingers sliding on strings and making that squealy noise. And you know what? It's great. It's so much realer. I know that's not a word, but but it is now. It's so much more authentic and so much more raw. And without that, it wouldn't have the character that it does.
Well, the thing is about this album also, what you were saying about the lyricism, you know, this was the album where Mike Watt finally became, he was someone who deservedly should have been up there with the pantheon of best lyricists to come out of the punk rock genre in general.
Yep.
For a start. And his couplings are just beyond spectacular. I mean, go to History Lesson Part 2, in which, you know, it's written by him, but it's delivered by D. Boone. And Boone's delivery is dry and deadpan and basically done in the second and third person. You know, me and Mike Watt playing guitars. We would get drunk, drive up from Pedro and Pogo. We were fucking corn dogs. But I was E. Bloom, Mick Jones, John Doe, and Joe Strummer. Me and Mike Watt. You know, it's brilliant. But okay, you brought up, do you want New Wave or do you want the truth? Well, how about political song for Michael Jackson to sing? Which has the immortal line in the middle of it. I must look like a dork. That's a Watt-ism, because Watt did that on the second Firehose album with the song for the singer of REM.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of shtick. That's a Watt shtickism. And it's just ungodly genius. But the jazz thing. Now, first of all, the Minutemen were one of the few punk rock bands who didn't play Denier. You ask them what their influences were, they would always say, with pride on their sleeves, shirts, hearts, and voices, Steely Dan, Creedence, Blue Oyster Cult. They love these bands.
Yep.
Absolutely love them, which is why they would always – Van Halen. That's why they would throw these songs in to the set. You know, it didn't matter that they were deconstructing them completely. They did them out of sheer love. That's all it was, which makes it a beautiful thing. In fact, on the next record that the Minutemen released, the Project Mersch EP, they actually cover Steppenwolf. They cover Hey Lottie Mama.
Yeah.
You know, it was a band that just you thought they were fucking around. What they did was they did stuff with a sense of humor. They didn't take it all that seriously. What they took seriously was getting the message of punk rock as being something that you or me or anyone else who was of that age, who had never picked up a guitar and who would only ever go to concerts and sit all the way in the back to see little mosquitoes up on a stage while you've paid your $25 for this shitty ticket. All they did was say, we've done it. You can do it. Look at us. D. Boone was a fat guy, a big fat guy who bounced around weightlessly on stage. You'd never know. It was almost comical how light he was on his feet.
Yeah.
Watt, who basically looked like a mental patient, allowed out of the hospital, given a bass guitar, with the faces he would make. And then there's George Hurley, who is probably the most underrated and uncelebrated drummer out there in music, bar none. You said the jazz skill, the chops. If you listen very carefully to what Hurley's playing, and we're not talking about just on Double Nickels, although he has his own moment, okay?
Yeah.
Hurley is a complete and utter jazz drummer times 50. I mean, you try and picture in your mind some of the truly – try to picture Art Blakey in a punk band, because that's the kind of thing that Hurley was doing with the overunders, with the hands and the syncopations and the drum rolls. And on stage, he always played with a drumstick in his sock, an extra drumstick in his sock. I mean, that was a really nice touch.
Yeah. But
his playing was this wonderful combination of not just jazz rhythms, but funk. We're talking Parliament Funkadelic funk, hard funk rhythms. If you listen to it, while there is a lot of the freeform element in the music of the Minutemen, especially on Double Nickels on the Dime, it's incredibly tight.
Yeah.
You think it's freeform, but it's the drumming that's the machine. And that machine is on the one.
Yep. Well, and it's another just great piece of music from 1984. Again, that's Double Nickels on the Dime from the Minutemen. And we get into new music. There's talk about terribly different directions. We're going to skip into one now that is a young lady that is profiled on Pop Dos this week. And we had talked about her because she plays guitar and provides some backing vocals for an album that we went over a couple of weeks back. And now she's got her, you told us at the time that Molly Tuttle's EP Rise was coming out. Now let's back up a second. Where did we hear her before?
We heard her on Corby Lenker's recent album. You know, he's the fellow that did the album recorded, you know, on a mountaintop in his father's mortuary.
In Idaho. Yeah.
Right. Right. And the two of them had co-written Friend and a Friend, and his version is on his album with her singing backup vocals. Her version is on this EP, Rise. But all I want to say is this, you know, it's seven songs. It's an introduction. I think it's a very generous introduction, because seven songs, really, once you've crossed over six songs, it's no longer an EP.
Right.
But okay,
yeah.
I digress. She immediately exudes a warmth and a charm the minute you hear her start to sing. Okay. Second of all, there is such a good feeling from the music and her vocals brought together. Case in point, there's a track called Good Enough, and it's kind of bluegrass. And it goes at that kind of clip that you want bluegrass to move. You don't like it when it's slow and almost dirgy,
right?
You know,
right.
And sputtering. This is just, you know, blink and you've missed it, which I think is great. But then she also knows how to convey emotion. There's a song called You Didn't Call My Name, which is about as sad as you can get. I mean, just the title alone is enough to tell you, but the emotion that she puts into the song really makes you feel like, okay, maybe she's experienced this. And it's one that's going to make you sad,
yep.
Which is exactly what you want. You want those songs to work. And she does it really, really well. But then there's a track called Save This Heart. And it's got this great guitar in it, which it just kind of has this guitar build that you're not expecting in this EP, frankly, because it's very country, bluegrass, Americana-ish. But it's got this guitar buildup that it's almost like listening to My Bloody Valentine if you can control them and the feedback that they use.
Right. Trace my finger on the map, trying to make out where you are. You know I do the best I can, but I can't take this anymore. Your letters get shorter, the days get longer. I call across the border, it's static on the line. Save this heart of mine.
Because it builds up and then it explodes, but then it's contained again.
Yep.
It's right. Like a little lightning burst.
And that song is the one that you've got linked on the page with the review. And I was really impressed by, I'm going to see if I can put this into words. There is an urgency about her playing in that song, about her guitar work. And usually it's a very difficult line to ride when you're playing with that kind of urgency to crank down a little too hard on everything. Your fingers tighten up on the strings. You strum a little bit too hard. Where she's able to play with that kind of urgency in that song and yet still use a very light touch. And the effect that that gives is, you just use the word control. That's what it is. It's a song that wants to get to where it's going in a very quick and expedient fashion, but it's always controlled. And the clear as a bell vocals over top of it really just bring all of that together. It's nice.
It's really that the EP is a winner as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So check out Molly Tuttle. And if you missed Corby Lenker or you missed our discussion about him, go back and check that one out as well, because that's another very cool thing. And we've got, I believe we are up to In Our Heads. Do we have anything else we missed that we want to go over before we get to In Our Heads?
Another, and I can't believe I let this one pass me by, fool that I am.
Dunphy.
There is another co-op communique compilation that is out and available now. It came out on September 4th. And this one is actually titled, and there's a concept to it. This is called Love's Labor Loosed.
Nice.
A co-op communique flash compilation. Once again, from the mind and heart of Mr. D.W. Dunphy, the patron saint of we underprivileged musicians of the New York, New Jersey, Fairfield County, Chrysler, Plymouth area. What this is a compilation of demos, you know, songs that, you know, were ideas, I don't know what you want to call it. This is the original versions of songs that either are coming out or have come out. It's just that these are the roughs. This was how they were originally conceived. And, you know, there's a lot of really great stuff on here. There are 14 tracks, a little less than our usual, but on it you'll find people like Mr. Dunphy himself with Standing in Your Spotlight, which is just the backing track. The Beatitudes with Only One Way to Know. Ken Paxton with The Ballad of Asaph Silsby. One of my favorite tracks on here, just because of the name of the band and the title of the song itself. The American Bandstand, Communist Brigade, formerly the Dick Clark Five. I left my heart on Home Surgery Mountain. It's one of my favorite artists on the face of the earth. One of the greatest musicians who's ever been. One of the finest human beings that God Almighty himself ever put on the planet. And just a dosh darn nice guy, me. So
there you go. How can you go wrong?
First, with one of my absolute all-time favorite of my own tracks, a song called Whatever Makes You Happy, which I started writing in 1994. Then I met this woman who you and I and everybody else under the sun refers to as The Mistake. For the next 3 years until she moved out, thank God. I forgot about the song. I put the half-finished lyrics in a desk drawer. When she moved out and I was able to reconfigure the apartment, I, you know, went back into the drawer and was tossing out papers. Oh, look what I found. And I finished the lyrics, and then the next day I did the music in one shot. I wrote it and recorded it. So what you hear is what was immediately recorded as soon as I constructed the tune. It's all one take. No, again, like the Minutemen, one take, no funny business. It is a great pop song. It's a pop song with a capital P. I've often said, and this is what I was thinking when I was actually writing the music for it and putting it together, I wish the punchline were together, because this would definitely be a great return to form single. So this is my demo version. It's from 1997. And I think you'll dig what you hear.
All right. So that is, you said that's on its way out, co-op communique?
It's out now.
It's out now.
It's been out since September 4th. You're welcome to go to my Facebook page if you listen to our show and are following me on Facebook. It's on there. You can hear the song. And then please go to the actual album page and give a listen. It's a lot of fun. These are wonderful compilations. Even if I wasn't on it, I'd be listening. I've listened to the first – well, the first one, because I wasn't on the first one. I didn't know about it. But, you know, they're great, and it's just such a joyful and important thing that Mr. Dunphy does for all of us.
Good deal.
For all musicians.
And that brings us quite nicely into our In Our Head segment once again, which is the highly acclaimed or whatever thing where we just talk about the shit that's been rolling through our heads this week. And when it comes to music, this has been kind of a neat week for me because – the Bret Michaels Band was in town. And when I say in town, I mean in Columbia, Illinois, of all places, which is a town of maybe 15,000 people. And they were playing a benefit for the veterans, which was a kind of a cool thing. But his guitar player is a guy by the name of Pete Evick. And Pete and I have been friends for years. He's a wonderful guy. And no matter what you think of Bret Michaels or Poison's music or any of that stuff, Pete is just one of those people that you can't help but dig. So we got to not only hang out for a little while at the concert on Friday night, but Thursday night, since they had the day off, he and the rest of the band outside of Bret went to a little bar on the Missouri side of the river and played an acoustic set over there. So we got to hang out and watch them do that. And as we were getting ready to leave, because I had to work in the morning, Pete said, "Oh, no, you're not getting out of here that easy," and pulled me up on stage and started playing the opening chords of the Refreshments' Bandidos. So, in a very impromptu fashion, I got to sing that song on stage with Pete Evick and the rest of that band. And that band, by the way, includes the ex-bass player from Cinderella and a whole bunch of guys who are just really, really talented musicians. So they picked up on it right away, and we just belted this thing out and had an absolute fucking blast with it. And what it reminded me of was the very first time that I ever did that. The very first time that I was pulled up on stage by a friend of mine in a little tiny bar in Tampa, Florida, that isn't even there anymore, in this little shotgun shack of a building in another part of the world. And we played rock and roll. We played Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll. And it was one of the songs I knew I could bang out with no problem. So we just sat there and hit it hard. And it was about the most fun I had ever had in my life. And Thursday night in High Ridge, Missouri, brought that all back. And I thought, you know, this is as much fun as the first time I ever stepped out on stage and played a song. And so I want you to dig back in your own memory banks into the first time you ever stepped on stage and played a song with a rock band. Do you remember what it was?
I do.
What was it?
The first song?
Yeah.
The first song was something that I had written, actually.
No kidding. That's
yeah,
brave.
The first time I ever stepped on stage with a rock band was with 2 Minutes Hate.
Okay.
So the first time I'd ever done it was Sunday, January 29th, 1984, at RT Fireflies on the corner of Bleecker Street and Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the opening song of the night was my song, Why Don't I Smile, which was really my Dirty Looks ripoff, my ripoff of Take a Life.
Okay.
I think that was the song that we opened the set with. And that was the first time I ever got up on stage and sang.
How'd it go?
With a band. Not by myself, because the first time I ever got up on stage and sang, I was on the cusp of 13, and it was at a talent show in my shul. And I got up and I sang, I'm not kidding, Beth and Hard Luck Woman.
Well done. Well done, sir. So once you got up and were playing your own music, how did it go? I mean, was it everything you thought it would be?
I just hated the band. I hated the guys who were with me.
Okay.
Because I was so angry with them at the time, you know, because they, you know, I'm glad that we did the show and people were saying, you guys are great. But I was in no mood to hear any of that. I was just so pissed at them because it was sloppier than it should have been. Now, from all accounts, because my parents were there, they said it was really good. You know, the only problem they had was with the sound system.
Uh-huh.
Because it didn't seem like the sound guy knew what he was doing. So 2 Minutes Hate had actually recorded 2 EPs, which came out. The first one was on cassette, and it was called Love, Hate, and Social Criticism.
Okay.
The second one was an actual, you know, 4-song vinyl EP called Seconds, Time Signatures, and Strings. And it's actually a really good four songs from a couple of 18-year-olds, you know, who pooled their money from working at McDonald's.
Yeah.
You know, and had shitty equipment, but it sounded really good. But then we started working on an album called What Have We Got? And we recorded all, you know, I would say just about an entire album's worth of material, and it just never came out because Joel, who was our second guitar player, left the band to go to college, and Vinny, our drummer, left to go back to New Jersey. So thus came the end of 2 Minutes Hate. So there was no point in putting out an album that was going to die a death.
Yeah. Well, the one thing, the one memory that I have from Thursday that's the one that's going to stick with me, even though I've been on stage a few times between then and now, is that while we were singing, while we were banging out Banditos, and you got to remember, I mean, this is the song that introduced me to the Refreshments. So I have been in love with this piece of music for 20 years now. And there's only one part in the song that has any harmonies to it, and it's the sort of pre-chorus, the everybody knows that the world is full of stupid people line. Everybody knows. And I know every note in that song like the back of my hand. So when it came to that, I knew he was going to sing the lead part, so I sang the harmony over top of him. Well, he wasn't expecting that. So in the musical break that came right after that first chorus, he kind of leaned over to me and went, "Was that you singing that high harmony?" I was like, "Yeah." And there was this look of appreciation of like a damn dude from a guy who makes his living on the road in the Bret Michaels band. And, you know, even though he and I have been friends forever, it doesn't make any difference when, as a musician, he gives that kind of respectful nod to me. That was an apple of gold, man. I'm going to take that with me and keep it for a long time.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, on the flip side of all of that, there are the times that I've actually gotten to get up and join a band on stage, which, like with your experience, the first time that I can actually remember, it might have happened before that. It might have been friends, because I remember getting up on stage with friends of ours when they were doing Teenage Kicks and taking the microphone, because, of course, nobody can do Sharky like I can do Sharky.
Right. You know?
But the Waxing Poetics, who were a great band from Norfolk and who were actually on the label that I was the manager of, Imergo Roadrunner Records. I joined them on stage for a show that they were doing at Princeton University. And I remember we did a couple of their songs. I just played, you know, guitar and backing vocals. But then we were all singing Uncontrollable Urge, which was hysterical. Right? That's one. But of course, you singing the Refreshments is a golden moment. And of course, what led you and I to start doing this, lo, those many years ago, was me being hauled on stage to join the Bongos on the night that Maxwell's closed to sing Big Star's Thank You, Friends.
Right, right.
Which, man, I will never have a bigger musical boner than that.
Yeah, I mean, my wife looked at me halfway through our drive home on Thursday night, and she was like, "You haven't stopped smiling yet." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm probably not gonna for a while."
Yeah, cold shower now. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I hear you, man. Well, that is our In Our Head segment, and that's our show for this week. And Rob Ross, like always, man, a barn burner. Fun times, and we'll look forward to. We got a whole bunch more to hit next week. We got any idea what's on the table?
Well, I'm sure Donald Trump will have plenty for us to talk about this coming week.
Oh, yeah.
There are a couple of new pieces of music out there that we'll get to, and one of them being from our friends from A Fragile Tomorrow, because Mr. Sean Kelly, the lead singer and rhythm guitarist, is about to step out on his own. So we're going to talk about that in depth, because we have an interview with young Sean coming up this week on Pop Dose.
Can't wait.
But there are a lot of other really good things on the dose. And as always, people should be looking at it, reading it, checking it out, you know, absorbing it, and then making notes, looking for the music that's out there or checking out the movies and the books. But by all means, people better sit up and take notice.
You got it, brother. I'll talk to you in a week.
All right, man. Be well.